We've been reading different vignettes from scripture. I feel are relevant to transition. Haven't been trying to draw too many lessons from them. I think we can all do that ourselves. But what we were going to talk about today is being agents of change. And this is one example of someone who had to get a kick in the pants rather than be patted on the shoulder to get the point of what his transition was all about. About noon the next day, as they were on their journey and approaching the city, Peter went up on the roof to pray. He became hungry and wanted something to eat. While it was being prepared, he fell into a trance. He saw the heaven opened and something like a large sheet coming down, being lowered to the ground by its four corners. In it were all kinds of four-footed creatures and reptiles and birds of the air. Then he heard a voice saying, "Get up, Peter, kill and eat." Peter said, "By no means, Lord, for I have never eaten anything that is profane or unclean." The voice said to him again a second time, "What God has made clean, you must not call profane." This happened three times, and the thing was suddenly taken up to heaven. Now while Peter was greatly puzzled about what to make of the vision that he had seen, suddenly the men sent by Cornelius appeared. Moving from, he had God in a box and had decided what was holy and what was profane, what was sacred and what was secular, and it took God to jolt him out of the box by visions of eating reptiles and such things, so that he would have finally accept Cornelius, the Gentile centurion. And if he hadn't, we wouldn't be here in a Christian setting, because he had the power to put down Paul out of Jerusalem when Paul started making his journeys. We offered yesterday afternoon, if you had a prediction that you wanted to write down and give to us, you were welcome to do that. You can give them to me now if you have them, if anybody did that. If you would like to do it but didn't and want a couple minutes now, raise your hand. We'll take a couple minutes. Otherwise, we'll just go on.
Mine's a pretty safe bet. It's going to be this or this or this. Okay. I mean, I could win no matter what I put down because I would put all these wild things. Well, maybe not, though. I could be
okay.
180
degrees. Okay. All right. Why don't we begin?
Well, being agents of change makes it sound like we're moving into an active phase. Sometimes we think change happens to us. And so this is one of the ways that you start to be an agent of change. Should I abide by the rules until they're changed or help speed the change by breaking them? Sort of along a little bit more lighthearted look at the same kind of thing that Peter was dealing with in the scripture this morning. Being an agent of change implies that you're involved in, you're being an actor in the change for yourself and for other people. And so I wanted to revisit this list of characteristics of the transition state as we put on our glasses that say, it's not only me in this, it's me and some other people in this. Whatever the change is that I'm undertaking, it's usually not just affecting me. Maybe the organization that I'm a leader in, maybe that it's a family group, it may be just one other person that you're going along with. But if you are the agent of change, you are taking a role in initiating something here. It's not just a passive role. And by being active in identifying some change that needs to happen, or even just a little discomfort that you have with the status quo, you tell somebody else about it and it has ripples. That puts you in a position of being somewhat responsible for what happens to the others as well as yourself. And so here we have some of the characteristics of the transition state, which are not true only for ourselves, but for the others around us. Low stability. In an organization that's going through change, status quo has been upset. And so the stability of it is not on balance anymore. That can be a feeling inside, but it can also be something that affects others. And since most organizations hope always to achieve stability in order to accomplish their goals, when low stability is a part of the mix there, then you have some discomfort. People are somewhat less than comfortable. And that can lead into the high emotional stress. If you've been a part of an organization, a congregation, a work unit that has had a change announced but not yet accomplished, you can see signs of people's stress levels going higher. In the reorganization that the department that I work for in the ELCA has been going through, emotional stress has its peaks and valleys, but it certainly is a part of the whole mix of bringing two disparate groups of employees together in one department. And if you don't take into consideration the fact that there is some emotional stress, then people's feelings get rid, the sense of being ridden roughshod over. You're not taking my problems into consideration, and then stress even escalates. We were talking a little bit with Ruth about some of the changes that a congregation goes through when there's a change in leadership. And depending on how close individuals are to the core of the organization, the more emotional stress there might be. People on the farther out edges, those who aren't as affected by the coming of a new pastor, for instance, or the leaving of the previous pastor and the space of time during which the interim pastor is there, those folks on the periphery may not be feeling as much emotional stress. But those who have been on the church council, those who have been on the call committee, all those folks are under some high degree of emotion. It may not always be perceived as negative. There's a portion of emotional stress that's excitement too. But there's the possibility of high emotional stress. The next one is high, often undirected energy. And in some of the material that Bridges uses in his managing change, he talks about organizations that have had an announcement that a change is going to take place, and yet not all of the details are in place, and folks are often scurrying around. It's almost like little rats running around, but it's not very directed energy because the goals are not clear. People aren't working together in one direction. We have a friend who works for AT&T, and if you know anybody that's worked for AT&T over the last few years, that has been a tremendous shift for those people who thought that they had a job that was secure for the rest of their lives. And with the divestiture and the breaking up of some components of that large organization, some departments have been just left sitting. Our friend has been told, well, in about 6 weeks, we'll know where we're going to be deploying all of you people. And then as it gets closer and closer to that deadline, they say, well, it's probably going to be another 4 or 5 weeks before we really know what's going to be happening with you. And so there's energy that these people have bottled up to do the work that they have been doing in the past, that they know how to do, but it's not directed. And so productivity in that unit within AT&T is just kind of at a standstill. People aren't taking the necessary steps in order to bring some resolution to it, because it's feeling like it's all coming from above them. It's out of their control. And so control becomes a major issue. Who really is in charge here? Who's in charge? The congregational issue is often one in which there's not exactly an overt battle, but there are tugs of who's really going to decide, make the resolution here of the situation. I see some of you nodding. Maybe you could give us some examples of how you see control playing out.
I think changing pastors would probably be a really good example, because if you're all at all involved in the church, you want some input on selection of that new one. You want a piece of control.
And if you're on the call committee and they tell you not to give that information, you're really in trouble.
Well, it seems to me that any, like with the organization I'm a part of, my work, when there's a major change, like we had a recent change of administrators, many sort of want a piece in how to run the place now.
Yeah.
Or criticizing the new way, and it seems to me that that's control.
And sometimes in our own personal changes, that wanting to be in control of something that's elusive causes us anxiety and sleepless nights wondering, how can I get back control over this? The fallow ground, the period of waiting that Jeanette shared with us in the reading this morning from that book, it's really hard to let go of being in charge and being in the driver's seat. Past patterns of behavior become highly valued. And that, we've talked about that quite a bit this weekend. I'd like to suggest that that's one of the functions that a congregation often plays for people. We often retreat into our congregations because they can, that setting allows us to feel comfortable with our past traditions. At least something is stable. We're singing at least one or two hymns that I still recognize. Not all of them, but some of them. And I think that that might be one of the reasons that some congregations, or many congregations, have a difficult time moving into something new. Because it's fellowship there is a haven for all these people who are buffeted by changes everywhere else in their life. Come back there, and so then if I become an agent of change, I see I want to have my congregation using inclusive language worship. Well, that rocks all of the foundations of all those other people who say, too much change everywhere else in my life. I want it to be stable and non-changing here. And so we look to the past like we did last night. That was really enjoyable. We had a lot of real pleasure out of singing those things that were from our past, from a time that we, some of us may even have had the thought, oh, it was better then. It was less complicated then. You're talking about old radio programs. There were less hassles. And we could have cast a golden oldie aura over some of that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But sometimes when we then begin to feel, say, in our congregation, a little bit of movement to inspire some change, even just a little bit, we meet more resistance than we had expected.
Do you think that maybe that's even more true in a place like the church? Because in the transitions that I've gone through, I either come back to Holden, or right after the vision therapy, my biggest desire was to return to Lutheran finish the part of the degree that I didn't do, to go back to that place that was really important for me. So if the church is that place for you, then change within that really
right
multiplies.
Yeah. Ruth,
yeah.
Recently a Sunday school class, we were watching the Petitions of the Lord's Prayer that Nestin did, mm-hmm. I guess, at conference. We're watching on video. And so I just threw out, there was a dead silence. I guess I didn't like that. And the pastor asked a question. I said, well, this isn't right on that. I missed the beginning. How did he introduce our Father? You know, what about all this thing to do with language and the mother image? And wow, we got some discussion, some angry feelings, too.
Our congregation has had some real energy around a remodeling project that's going to make it accessible, make the sanctuary accessible. And there's a real faction that says, well, we really don't have that many people that need that, and why should we do that? Because my parents helped to build this place the way it is now. It's fine the way it is. We'll all help if there's somebody in a wheelchair. We'll all go out to the curb and, you know, help them in because we don't want to see any change here. So conflict increases.
I remember listening to stories from some of the old timers when they would describe the language change, our forebears came with German, Norwegian, Danish, whatever, and then there was that terrible transition to English, and all kinds of stories came out of those, but one that sticks in my mind is in a Norwegian church, they were at a meeting debating whether to go to English or to stay with Norwegian, and one of the old-timers was campaigning to retain Norwegian, and he said, if it's good enough for Jesus, it's good enough for me.
That was Nina Rowe.
Now, the other day, when I put up the jagged chart with the stages of grieving on it, and I was titled Response to a Negative Change, I said I was going to show Response to a Positive Change. And so that's what this one is. And yet, this dimension is still called pessimism. And it might be called skepticism, but definitely we are resistant to change. And so our mental attitude might be pessimistic. The first stage of something that has been announced to you, or that you've chosen even to embark on, is uninformed optimism. That was Carl skipping after I called and said we're moving to Chicago. Uninformed optimism. You're certain that this is a wonderful thing that's going to be happening. And so time passes, and some of the things that have to go into making that change start to happen. Well, as you go up here, you're bridging into a much more pessimistic state, and the second phase is informed pessimism or doubt. And at that point, there are a couple of arrows that show checking out. Now, if it's within an organization, and let's say it's been announced that there's going to be a new headquarters. Well, that sounds like a really neat thing. We've needed a new building. Our current place is cramped, it's not convenient. It looks like this is going to be really cool. However, as we find out that it's going to take away some of the resources for doing our current work because the money's going to be poured into building, we become somewhat pessimistic. But the day that we actually have to move to the new building, we see really how bad it's going to be. And some people check out at that point or earlier on. Within a group of people, some of them say to themselves, this is not going to work, but I guess I'm stuck here and I'm going to put up with it, but I'm not going to really cooperate. And that's sort of a private checking out. Then there's a public checking out, and you say that to everybody around you, and you say, even, I'm quitting. This just is not worth all this hassle. I'm leaving. And so there are a couple of bailout points, at least, along that way.
That's a congregation, you know, when a switch in pastors, you always have a casualty list of people who will transfer to another church at that point. Yeah. Or a building program.
Mm-hmm.
Or a merger.
But let's say the vast majority stick it out. And round, it's still after informed pessimism. You live there for a little bit longer and you get worse because the hassles are increased. But then time continues to pass and you can go to hopeful realism. We're still not there yet. It's not that neat, but it's getting better. And I can see the light at the end of the tunnel. In our personal transitions, that's when we're beginning to glimpse the new beginning. And then we come down to informed optimism. We've experienced a bit of it. It feels okay. It's not totally okay yet, but our experience of it now has informed us a bit more so that we're beginning to have a growing sense of confidence in this change.
I would think that if I were a real estate person, I would, you always deal with this, I think they call it buyer's remorse.
Mm-hmm.
We've done that enthusiastically, make a down payment on a property, woo, and then back that way.
Right.
And Kansas, I think we've done that two or three times now.
Uh-huh.
Enthusiastically move into a new, and then change our mind, get cold feet, and bail out.
Yeah, but you probably bailed out before you hooked up the refrigerator.
That's correct.
Yeah, at some point, you decide that it's harder to go back than it is to go forward.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
As a former real estate person, I contest a lot of those, and luckily my style is different than some people, but I just wanted to add that the way that you can really overcome getting into a position of buyer's remorse is, as you have been saying, checking out all the stages carefully as you go. And then my role becomes not talking someone into something, but reminding them of what they've already told me that they wanted.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Good. And so what you're, another thing that comes to my mind is you're saying that if you are one of the leaders of this change operation, doing just that, being with the people through this, going around the curve. If you're an absentee leader, like I think in this AT&T situation there, it's hard to say who the leader is, and there's really a lack of information about what's going on, then I would imagine that those folks are off the chart in terms of informed pessimism and don't have any balancing components of new information that helps them to get down to informed optimism. Information is a real key ingredient all along the way. The more you feel like you're in the dark about something, you're wondering and you're in Mark's molasses of the morass. The goal here, of course, is complete satisfaction, but knowing how likely we are never to reach it, that's why the line doesn't come totally together there. So the same thing as the bell-shaped curve, there's always going to be a gap there. Really, on this side of heaven, feel totally satisfied.
Whose graph is this?
This is a graph that I got from a workshop on managing change, and it was done by a consulting firm called ODR, Organizational Design Resources. It's the, I was telling Ruth last night that one of the large hospitals, Lutheran General Hospital, is putting all of their managers through a program called Managing Organizational Change, and because they feel that not just the one change that they might be going through now, but in order to prime this organization for continually living with change, that they want all of their folks to have some handles on how to deal with personal and organizational. And so this next chart also comes from that stages of change commitment. And so you have time again on that dimension. And on the vertical, you have the degree of support for the change. Now this is, can also be applied to groups or to individual walking through change. There are three phases here. One is the preparation phase, the middle is the acceptance phase, and the final is the commitment phase. So that by entering into the preparation for a change, you may not be required yet to commit to it. The commitment, the final commitment of internalization of it is the eighth step along the way. And that you go through a lot of stuff in order to get all the way to the internalization of it. So let's walk through it. The first point is contact. You have some idea that there's going to be a change. your husband comes home and says, we're moving. And we're going to Alaska. We've been living in Houston. We're going to Alaska. That's contact. It was preceded by unawareness. only the one person in this party had perhaps been stirring around with that idea. And the announcement, and then that leads to some awareness of what the ramifications are going to be. It also has the downside of confusion. We talked a bit about that before. And that's really all that happens in the preparation phase. Within a large organization, though, some of the leaders need to be talking to the people about what is all going to be involved in this change. In our division, with the change that we went through, we, as a whole group, brainstormed a variety of options for ourselves. We were told by the bishop that we're going to have to reorganize. And we were given the opportunity to brainstorm, give some options. Maybe we should stay the way we are. Maybe we should propose that we take in other functions to our particular department. And so that was the contact, but it was preceded by a big C down there of unawareness. And then the awareness that the change was really going to take place was paired with a great deal of confusion. When is this going to happen? How is it going to happen? What's its effect going to be on me? Am I going to lose my job because somebody else coming in has a similar kind of job to mine? Cross over this dotted line here and we begin to understand the change, understand all of the ramifications, and so there's a negative perception that goes along with it, and we've just seen that on another graph. The positive perception of it is also a flowing out of understanding it. So to spend as much time as you need trying to understand it. When you're getting ready to move, you're checking out all of the moving companies and how much it's going to cost to use this moving company or that moving company. Where are the kids going to go to school? All of those pieces. The negative side is, ooh, this is going to be a lot of work. It's going to be pretty expensive. Do we have the money to do it? And so that's why this is called, over here, it's called the disposition threshold. Maybe we can get out of it yet. The positive perception has the downside of the decision not to attempt it or to support it. Well, I guess I'll go along. We'll move to Chicago, but I'm not going to be happy. I'll show you. That's the decision not to support the installation of it. Let me just stop there. Can you relate any of these phases to stuff that you've been through?
You're helping me immediately right now because I'm going to stop teaching piano and I'm going to have approximately 20 parents who are going to go all through this as they discover that they've got to do something different for the child.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, knowing what they're going to experience will help me to know how to present it and deal with them as they cope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Giving them some information about where else their children can get lessons. And how you're not stopping this because you hate your child.
Right.
In that understanding the change, or in that section there, through understanding the change and the negative perception, just
speaking personally about, that's when I get into that catastrophic thinking, the very worst is going to happen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And can make it really magnify.
Yeah.
To realize what I'm doing.
Mm-hmm.
It's a real hard period.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to over, I mean, it comes in and out.
And lest you think that this diagram is the way it really happens, that it's all on just a straight upward course, let me remind you again that in all of these things, there's a lot of up and down. And there may be back to this confusion, needing to go back and review why I thought this was a good idea in the first place. Or what does the leader of this change see is really all of the positives about it? Sell me again. Anything else? Okay, now then you've gotten to where you're going. You've moved into the new office building, you've merged with another organization, you've made the move, and yet you see that there are four stages up there of really truly committing to it, of buying in totally. The installation is the lowest one there. That means that the change has happened. We've gotten everybody now in our organization on computers. But there's still the downside here is change aborted after initial utilization. And a lot of this organization's work, ODR's work, was first with companies where they were putting in computers. And they would see everybody had a PC on their desk, and yet many of the secretaries were using the typewriters. The equipment was installed, but they had said, none of this for me, folks. I'm not gonna do any of this.
Wasn't there a lot of that because some big, important, powerful person can snoop too and call up what they're doing and monitor them. Sure. A whole lot more control and over them.
Well, that could have been one of the rumors circulated throughout the organization. You're shaking your head.
Well, we've gone through in my business a number of situations, new computer hardware and software systems. Actually, we had one experience a number of years ago where we actually installed some new hardware, and the experience with it was so unsatisfactory that we did throw it out and kind of back up and start over again. So that's an option.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an option. And if you can allow that door to still be open and not make it a penalty to the folks who identified that this isn't working. In one of the Bridges books, he has a good deal of examples about how people showed the company that what they were, the path they were going down was not going to accomplish the goal that they had set out. And they didn't get anywhere. The company said, whether this works or not, we're on this path. We're going down it. So, the next phase is adoption. And there's still the option of change aborted after extensive utilization. That's more when you have checked it out and you see that it's not working. The balance is saying, well, we're not going to adopt this change. Then institutionalization of it is most everybody is doing it. And so I guess I better go along. I see people at every workstation around me using the computer. They're getting comfortable with it, and I can't do my work anymore if I don't, if I'm not going along with it. Everybody else is feeding into the central system, and I'm not. And so I'm being personally penalized for my own work output for not doing it. And then finally, internalization. I like it. I'm real thrilled to be able to use the computer. And this was a good change. I support it wholeheartedly. So you can see as a leader, as a change agent, how many points along the way that you have to encourage people. Feed them information, give them some encouragement. On a personal dimension here, as you're moving your family into going all the way with you to Alaska, the various points along the way are oftentimes the outs here aren't real options. The wife and children are not going to go back to Houston, but they're going to give you a lot of grief about being where you are. And sometimes I've known clergy that have stayed less than a year at a situation because there was never a positive perception on the part of their family that this was a decent place to live, that it was a good situation. And so the pressures to revert back to something that was remembered as being better caused the whole thing to just fall apart. I'm sure that in some of the families that you worked with in Stavanger that there were pressures pulling on them to not make the change and internalize.
Yeah, and some of them never did. They coped by going back to the States every Christmas and Easter and summer, and it was just sort of like a suburb of the U.S. What about the situation if somebody's making this change and they realize they have made a mistake? You know, maybe, I mean, that happens too.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well,
and they have to back up.
But you count the cost, I think. You have to say, is it possible here to, after we've extensively experienced it, can we get out of it? For some people, saving face is important. How can we get out of it when not be just so terribly embarrassed by all the pressures, all the others around us that would kind of give us a lot of negative sanctions? Sometimes there are checkpoints along the way. You keep touching base and saying, shall we go the next step?
If you're linked up with a significant other, you can have that person be the agent for getting out of it while you're
yeah. Sometimes in a situation, it's a good situation
leaving because of your wife's health.
I was thinking of that. Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, not just as an excuse. That person, no one has to know about it even. But that person is starting to pave the way for the next transition for the family. Rather than both of you having to sit and cry about it all the time.
That's just an interesting perspective, you
two. I was an interim pastor in a congregation where the pastor, wife, and kids were lots of internal transitions in their own lives, and then moved to a remote place in Alaska, and it was a nightmare for everyone. And to make a long story short, the wife's health became the, I guess I would call it the scapegoat for reverting back to a safer place. But no one was ever, people had to keep convincing themselves that that in fact was the reason, and no one was, including myself, convinced that that was the reason for the move. But it enabled the family to save face.
Interject one of the things that my counselor told me about family planning, which was, she said, this is not a time to marry, divorce, sell something dearly important to you. She said, if I was to stop teaching piano, which is happening, don't sell the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Find a way to maintain that studio, leave yourself a way back. She said, it is a great time to explore and see new options and put out feelers that, like you say, a temporary job. You don't have to jump in wholehearted to something new right away. That makes sense.
Yeah. There was a book written a number of years ago by a woman who had just been widowed. Widow is the name of it, by Lynn Kane. And she had lived her entire life in Manhattan, never driven a car. Childhood, growing up, marriage, always in Manhattan. And when her husband died, she sold their co-op and moved to the suburbs within about 3 months after he died, and found herself totally adrift, without any connection. Not even knowing how to drive a car, trying to buy a car, find out all of the details of getting around, because nobody told her that this is a crazy making time and don't make any major life changing decisions while you're getting accustomed to the dramatic change in your relationships here. So she realized probably after a year that this was not at all what she wanted to do. She first thought that she had burned all the bridges and realized that she really hadn't, that she could realize at least some profit from the whole move. Not a lot of monetary profit, but a lot of learning, and went back to Manhattan. Resumed a lifestyle that was much more comfortable for her and appropriate.
I was thinking of how your thing yesterday in terms of values would be really important, that I think sometimes until you've made a transition, you don't realize what some of the values that you hold are and how important they maybe are.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to say, when I went back to school, leaving my hometown and my home and changing friends and activities and all those things, I kept my house. I was able to do that when my sons lived there. But I felt that was a bridge. I felt that I couldn't handle also selling my house. That would just cut everything, and I just emotionally couldn't handle that. It was a real secure thing to hang on to that.
Yeah.
And then when I finished that period, I sold it, and it felt better, a lot better.
So some of us should not just jump off the edge of the cliff without any bungee cord that would help to maybe pull us back. Garrison Keillor has a wonderful quote here, and I'm sorry I don't have it on an overhead, but it's a little convoluted, so you have to listen closely. Some luck lies in not getting what you thought you wanted, but getting what you have, which once you have it, you may be smart enough to see is what you would have wanted had you known. Some luck lies in not getting what you thought you wanted, but getting what you have, which, once you have it, you may be smart enough to see is what you would have wanted had you known. Change is all around us, and it's not going to go away. And that's part of the whole theme of what we've been talking about here, both personally, family-wise, organizationally, congregations, whatever. But sometimes we have the ability to change the pace of it. We can learn from what we have, from our mistakes in the past changes, or from what worked well in the past changes, so that we're prepared for the next ones. But denying that change is going to take place around us is probably the only thing that you can't get by with. The one book of Bridges concludes with a quote that a journey is a trip in which the baggage has gotten lost. We like to think of journey as sort of a more encompassing term, but we have to realize that we may be embarking on something where we're going to be in the middle of the big lake and not be able to see either shore. So we have tried to just share with you a bit of our journeys, and you've done a marvelous job of sharing with each other the journeys that you have been on. We are not the experts in it, as you've certainly proven that you all are experts in all of the things that you've been struggling with in your lives and the journeys that you've been on. But it's really been a pleasure to have shared this time. Carl has the concluding story to share.
Something that struck me during the discussion this morning, a lot might be several of us in this group, in addition to the other changes, thinking about retirement. And one of the best resources we found for that, if you take pre-retirement courses or talk with somebody about that, it's usually heavily financially weighted, and what you're going to do with the real estate and what you're going to do with your accounts and what you're going to even do with your activities. There's a whole another part of that that you might be more attuned to after we've looked at transition the way we have the last couple days, and that's what goes on inside. If you're dealing with that transition, the best resource we've found, we did a workshop on it, was called a book called The Reality of Retirement. It's by a Revlon executive who had to take early retirement, and it took him years to get over it, and finally killed him. His widow's still alive, but it's the most insightful book we've ever dealt with, The Reality of Retirement. It was, I'm not sure it's in print, having said that. We had to contact the widow to get copies of it for the workshop. If you can find a copy of that book, it might be very helpful to you. It starts with a Z, and I can't remember. It's Jules. Z.
Look in your library under the Z's.
It's not Burn. No. Maybe Swag. I'm not sure though. One of the things we haven't dealt a lot with is, in that same vein, what are the realities of the transition? That means that to make a good transition, we're always balancing two things. The things you cannot change in the situation, such as we must move to such and such a place, or my spouse will no longer be there. That's just a given, you can't change it. And on the other hand, how I can maintain my own identity in this new transition. Because if I can, I'm never gonna like it. Now, I'm not gonna be the same old me exactly that I was before the transition, but that's what'll decide it pretty well. How much do I feel my identity is being maintained and fed in zone three when I get there? So there's a man named Ed Hayes, who some of you know. I know Dwight knows him. He's the guru, Roman Catholic diocesan priest who went to Japan and studied for a while. So he's got a combination of Roman Catholic theology and Zen. And you've heard about the Zen master that ordered a hot dog at Wrigley Field saying, make me one with everything. But anyway, Jules.
I said what?
Make me one with everything. Hayes has a combination of Eastern mysticism and his Roman Catholic background, and he is the presider at a place called Shantivanam outside Leavenworth, Kansas. That means Forest of Peace. I've not been there. Ruth has. And it's, but I talked to a lot of people who've been there, and his services are so moving and so well structured that you kind of have to get tickets to worship there on Sunday morning. And at the end, apparently, he walks through a wall, ascends kind of. It's just very.
He opens the glass door. And, he doesn't levitate.
But his stories are, in my opinion, very special. Seen a couple of his books now, and he's got one that deals with transition called The Fig Tree, and we wanted to close with that. Balancing, maintaining my identity with the givens of the situation. For several years, the young fig tree had been without fruit. She had drunk fully of the rain, soaked up the warm rays of the sun, and absorbed her share of goodness from the earth, but yet no fruit had been found on her branches. The owner of the orchard had no patience for what he considered parasites. Cut her down, he ordered the gardener. Please, sir, said the gardener, please give her just one more year. Allow me to nurture her and to challenge her. One more year, and then if she's still barren, well, I'll have her cut down. Shaking his head and mumbling to himself, the owner agreed as he walked away from the gardener, saying, one more year. But that's all, one more year. The gardener began by putting manure around the tree. The fig tree pretended not to notice and only raised her head higher in the sky. He then dug about the tree with his shovel, and as he did, he spoke to the tree. Everyone and everything that lives has a vocation. It's the calling to be yourself. The fig tree said nothing, but only sighed inwardly. Who wants to be themselves if they're only a fig tree? She thought to herself. Fig tree, you see, thought that fig trees were too common. She had tried to be an apple tree for years, but no apples appeared on her branches. She even went to college and took all the courses necessary to become a pear tree, but no pears appeared. So she then resorted to taking a home correspondence course entitled How to Be a Banana Tree. From this and all her other efforts, only frustration and the fruits of failure grew on her. I need to find a job that I can enjoy, said the fig tree. A job and a vocation, replied the gardener, are two very different things, my dear fig tree. A vocation has about it a sense of mystery, but a job is like a task, something to be done and not lived. A vocation comes from your very roots, from deep down in the dark depths of yourself, and you have fig tree roots. No thanks, said the fig tree. I prefer to be more novel. I think I'll go over to the laboratory and have them cross-gene me. You know, have them perform a graft with some other tree so that I can be really special. Who knows, perhaps I can become a banana apple tree. Think of the news coverage, not to mention the demand for my fruit, if they could shake up my genes like that. The gardener shook his head and stopped digging as he said, "There is something most special about you even now, little tree. You can be creative in the truest way of living out the mystery of your fig tree-ness. You then become not only something special, but also something sacred. By responding to the challenge to become yourself, you will find yourself in the presence of the real mystery, God. However, both life and God will escape you if you attempt to be what you are not intended to be. And remember, you only have one more year. The master said he was going to have you chopped down if you do not bear fruit this year." "I wish I could run away," said the fig tree. "Oh, to have the gift of locomotion like dogs and cats, there's an idea. I could become a traveling tree. I would need special roots that could stand the wear and tear of walking."